Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisian, Woozy Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to the inaugural episode of Who's Who Review, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, the Irredeemable Shag, and along with me is my co-host, the esteemed Rob Kelly. Buddy, how you doing?
It's the Who's Who Review, coming right at you, where three delightful animals have fun with what they do. We learn with our friend Shag and his helper Rob with... Oh, never mind. Let's just... All right. I'm not going to keep singing. That's ridiculous.
Is that our new theme song? I don't know what theme you're putting on the front of this, so I'm excited if that's it.
It was either that. I was either going to sing or do the gesture for stretching, which is what we're doing with this show. But of course, nobody could see that because this is a podcast.
To be fair, that is true. We are stretching because, you know, we wanted to find a way to continue this podcast. And also, I mean, the fact is we love the Who's Who comic books, right? And we love this podcast. It's a lot of fun. It really, honestly, we said it before, this built our network. I really feel that way. So it gives us a chance to talk about Who's Who in a fresh way. So why don't you explain for people at home, like, the because this was kind of your brainchild. Mine was to keep it going. You're the one who had this idea. So why don't you explain kind of the germ of the idea, and then I'll explain the details that you leave out.
Okay, fair enough. So the idea that I sort of came up with, partially based on Siskoid's use of the randomizer on his panel to panel show, we have that idea right there. And then it was combined with the fact that a couple of things about the Who's Who shows, which was born out of Shag pulling clips from the episodes in front of the Who's That episodes, was a lot of those Who's Who shows sound terrible. The audio quality is really bad.
Oh, the audio quality. I thought you meant you, but okay.
Yeah, no, well,
you
that too. No, the audio quality is very terrible because my mic setup back then was really, really bad. And I didn't really know much of what I was doing. I was, you know, I was using what I had, so the audio quality is really bad. Two, we've changed. You and I have changed. We've evolved over 12 years. At least I hope so, for the love of Pete. I mean, we're kind of bad people. We're exactly the same. So our opinions might be a little bit different. Three, the Who's Who episodes, when they started out at a manageable length, but then they grew to, you know, monstrous proportions. And it was the kind of thing where if somebody wanted to go back and listen to a particular entry for some reason, that's a lot to wade through. You know,
it's like 3 hours by the end of it.
Yeah. I mean, right. You're like, oh, I want to hear what they thought about the demon. Well, I got to go find that episode and then, you know, navigate all the way to, oh, wait, I shot past it. Let me go. Deimos. No, that's too far. You know, that kind of stuff. And so I thought it would be kind of fun to kind of, with all that in the mix, I thought it'd be kind of fun to use again the randomizer, use a randomizer and go back and apply it to those classic issues of Who's Who. And we will pull up entries and we will review them now as if we are seeing them. I mean, we're obviously not pretending we're seeing them for the first time. We all know them chapter and verse, but maybe we feel differently about them than we did back then. Now, I know I did not go back to listen to the old episodes and find out what we said. I'm too lazy to do that. Maybe some of you crazy people might do that, but you know,
I don't want them to, because like I very purposely am not going to re-listen to the old stuff. So like we may end up saying exactly what we said 11 years ago, or we might have entirely new ideas. I don't know. But frankly, I don't want to worry about what we said back then, because this is about moving forward. This is about how we feel today.
Exactly. So I just thought that was kind of a neat way to dip back into the great Who's Who listings. On a plus side for me, there'll be a lot less of those Gray Legion entries, which is really a big plus. And it just, as Shag said, it's a way to keep this show and this thread alive. But we get to kind of go back and do the stuff that we really enjoyed. And so that's sort of what we're doing.
And the fact is, this volume, the original volume of Who's Who, which, by the way, that's what we're focusing on, is just the original 26-issue volume. That's our favorite. You know, I love the loose leaf. I really do. I love the updates. All of them have a passion for, you know, especially a lot of the stuff in the loose leaf. But the fact is, the first 26 issues are really great. And so thinking about this, if you're like, well, you guys just talked about this. Well, if you just listened to them, maybe so. But for Rob and I, we recorded Who's Who issue number one back in May 2012. Okay. And we finished issue 26 in February 2015. So that means.
Wow. We did those at a good clip.
We did. We really did. Considering how long it took us to do the rest. But that means the last time we discussed these particular entries was anywhere from 8 to 11 years ago. So that is a really, really long time for us. So as Rob said, you know, we've really changed it. So it'll be interesting for us to take a look at this with, well, I don't know if I should call them fresh eyes. We could say older eyes. How's that?
Definitely older eyes. Yeah. Older,
maybe a little more calm eyes. I don't know. But again, it gives us a way to look at, and also, oh, by the way, having it all mixed up, it's not going to be a slog of A's, a slog of B's. You know, it's, oh, okay. Now we get to just randomly get whatever. So it's a fresh way to look at this. And what we do is I indexed every single entry in the original Who's Who run. It's 833 entries, by the way, in the original Who's Who run. So we use a randomizer. We pick and a randomizer gives us 13 numbers. We check it on there and we pull those 13 entries. And, you know, we did prep for it. It's not like we're doing it right now. We prepped for it a week or two ago. So we know what entries we're doing. And as we go along, we'll keep doing this every episode of Who's Who review. We'll do another random 13 entries. Now, if we get, we're never going to repeat an entry. If we get the same number again, we'll just exclude that from there. So you get 13 brand new ones each time. And, you know, if we get really lucky, Rob, maybe we'll have an entire episode of like randomly picked Omega Men of Forever people entries. That would be the best, right?
Hey, look, we are taking our chances with this.
We really are.
And so I think it would be kind of hilarious if we ended up with like 13 Omega Men listed or like the Forever People. That would be great though if we weren't eliminating entries and just every month it's the damn Forever People. It would just feel like, oh, come on. No, we are going to be eliminating entries. And you know what? One other thing I will mention just on a personal, on a personal level, when I've gone back and listened to some of those old episodes, I'm just way crankier than I am now. I think I was a lot more negative because honestly, my life was not in as good a place as it is now. So I think I'm a little more, I would say I'm a lot happier person now than I was 12 years ago. And yeah, you can attest to that. And I think that will color my view. I think I was a little more trying to be snarky sometimes. And as I've gotten older, I'm like, why am I being snarky about Who's Who, which I loved? Like, that's weird. Like, why am I trying to be that way? So, you know, look, obviously if we get an entry that I still think is pretty weak, we'll say it, but yeah. I just think I have a different view of it now than I would have. Again, we're talking for some of these entries 12 years ago.
Well, and this volume, you know, originally had what, like 32 issues per volume or pages per volume. So we had to get through a whole lot more. So here, taking it down to 13, it gives us a chance to maybe, I don't know if we're necessarily going to spend more time in an entry, but we can give it more attention. You know, like I can go, oh, well, you know, I've got Arion, Lord of Atlantis. I'm going to spend a little more time on that than I would be because I got to get through Atlantis, Aquaman, Aqualad, Aquagirl, all that kind of stuff.
13 is a manageable size. It's a good idea. I think that was your idea to say, we're not going to do a whole book. Let's do half a book.
Yeah.
Not even a little less than half a book. But yes, that makes these episodes manageable in length to listen to and record.
And it gives us a chance. We'll be doing feedback on the back end. So please leave comments on the show post, which is over at firewaterpodcast.com. Leave your comments there. And next episode, we will read your feedback from Who's Who Review number one. So if you guys didn't get a chance to leave your feedback the first time around, 12 years ago or whatever it was, feel free to do it now, or maybe you got new thoughts yourself. Would love to hear it. Mm-hmm. So with all that, you know, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors, Rob. So folks, this episode is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collect editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, Rob, I got a wild guess what you're going to pick, but what'd you pick this time?
Well, I looked at what you picked and I just picked the other thing, which was Who's Who Omnibus Volume 1 Hardcover. The network helped will these into existence.
Oh, yeah.
There is no way anybody can prove otherwise. It is a giant tome of a book, a phone book of a Who's Who listing. It collects a bunch of issues of Who's Who, plus the updates, plus pages from the annuals, which is nice, a nice bonus feature. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't feature Atari Force, right?
Yeah, so right? So Atari Force won't be in the, now they're still in our selection database. So, you know, everything right. that's in the original Who's Who is in our selection database. But if you're following along from the omnibus, which you could, by the way, it should be a pretty cool way to do, yeah, that they won't be in there.
Right, because it's some bizarre copyright thing. But anyway, Atari
is in the name. I mean, come on.
Right. Yeah. And they, yeah, they were putting the whammy on themselves, I guess, in the beginning. But anyway, everyone knows it's the cover by George Pérez. It's kind of a mixed cover. Like it's got all these different, you know, figures from different covers all mixed together. And you actually do see on the cover, Babe is on the cover, even though
he's a member
of Atari Force. But anyway, the normal price is $159 in stock, trade price $87. You save 42% off. Again, these are just behemoth of books. And if you don't want to go by and track down the original Who's Who's with all their kind of dodgy printing and stuff like that, this is the great alternative.
You know, I think I will. You mentioned the covers. I think that may be the thing I'm going to miss most is we don't have covers for these because we're doing, little individual entries. But so in the same spirit, I picked Who's Who Omnibus Volume 2, which we also willed into existence, which collects Who's Who in the Legion, issues 1-7, all the loose leaf and the update. Again, cover, it's one of those collage covers. So they're pulling stuff with George Pérez and Brian Bolland. If I remember it, I think that one has the cover where they pull the images from the binders, which is pretty cool. But page count, 1,216 pages, full color. Hardcover, it normally goes the same price, $150, but you get it for 42% off, so it's only $87. They're absolutely amazing. They're wonderful, and these are great collections to own. And just wallow in your love for Who's Who, folks.
And each one, even if you just bought one, it's free shipping.
Yeah, and you can kill an intruder in your house with it. I mean, it won't be a problem at all. And it will stop a bullet if they shoot at you. So, all right. So, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. That was me stumbling over my words, but I'm just going to pretend it was an internet hiccup that really warbled that for you, folks. Okay.
There you go.
So, this episode is also sponsored in part by your Patreon support, folks, because, you know, running the network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you guys really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying shows like the Who's Who podcast or Who's Who review, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, consider supporting the Firewater Podcast Network. And in certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the Who's Who podcast. So our thanks go out to Damian Drew A. Whiter, David Ace Gutierrez, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, Mike Atchison, Nathan Archer,
Gord Tolton, Noah Tarnow, Steve Givens, Tom Perrine, and Tom Panarese.
Again, just visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. All right. So, folks, I am going to post these images since we're only doing 13. I'm going to put them on our website. We'll have an image gallery. So they're not going to be huge. So you may not be, I don't know. I'm going to just screenshot them from DC Infinite. So I don't know if you'll actually be able to read the text or not, but you'll at least be able to see the image. Otherwise, you know, hey, buy the omnibus, read them on DC Infinite. You got ways to get them. So, leave your comments on the website. We will read them in the next episode. And, you know, by the way, Rob, it's fair to say too that this isn't the sole be end all of everything we're gonna do with Who's Who. I mean, we're still gonna continue to do some Who's That episodes where we do a deep character focus. I've got a couple more ideas for some flashback episodes to do specifically coming up. Not a lot now that we're doing this, not as many, but I still have a couple flashback episodes I want to do. So with that, I think we're gonna go ahead and get started, aren't we? Woo, this is so exciting. So folks, the randomizer, here is your menu today. We'll just read them out as we go, but your first choice on the menu is Arion, Lord of Atlantis. Now, this comes from issue number 1 of Who's Who. So the art here on this entry is by Jan Durashima. And the image, which you've got here, is Arion in his blue and red and gold, kind of orangey costume, you know, doing a very heroic sort of flying mysticism pose. Because, you know, Arion's all about fantasy, sword and sorcery. So he's got his hand raised, and he's got that very iconic, I don't even know, how would you describe that power signature he's got on his top hand?
I don't really know what you would call that. It's like it's got a sort of like a matrix pattern sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's got a slight pentagram sort of feel to it.
Yeah,
not in a devil sense, but that kind of thing.
Well, and then behind him in the serpent, there's that word serpent.
Serpent
is the kingdom of Atlantis, and then below that is two beautiful images of his parents, and then him with Lady Chan getting it on. So a little bit of history for you here. Tell me about the art. Yeah, before we get into this, I'm sorry. What do you think about the art?
No, it's terrific. I mean, I love Jan Durashima, not just because I have to get in my obligatory mention. She went to the same school as me, the Joe Kubert School of Cartoon and Graphic Art.
Wait, there you're it with is, her?
Everybody. Yes. You know,
take a drink, folks.
Again, I'm not going back to listen to the old entries, so maybe we're repeating ourselves. But anyway, I am struck by how gorgeous the logo is. Like, that is a really excellent logo. I don't know if that's Todd Klein or whoever, I don't know, whoever did it, but that is a really killer logo. That was one of the complaints we had about the loose leaf entries, is that so often the logos were just, you know, a typeface that they just sort of spat out. And of course, you know, this was designed for the book, but I don't know. I just look at that. I'm like, man, that is a killer logo. I mean, it's a great piece overall by Jan Dersima, but man, I'm like, that really is a winning piece of merchandising for the character.
Well, and that same sigil that I was trying to describe earlier is in over the O. So you can actually see Arion's power signature image over the O. It looks great. I also want to comment on in the surprint, the image of his mother is just beautiful. I mean, she's just stunning. She's got sort of the pharaoh headdress. And then I've always liked his costume too. I think I don't know, something about the padded shoulders. Maybe I just, cause I grew up in the 80s. I like padded shoulders. I don't know, but, it just looks sharp up. I have a soft spot for the character. So I'll tell you guys a little bit about it. So the character is created by Paul Kupperberg, friend of the show, network, I should say, and Jan Dersima. And in the story itself, the way it goes is like his parents were mystical people. His father was very attached to sources of light. His mother was very attached to sources of darkness. They had two sons, Arion and Garn. And Garn and Arion were very much enemies. And the mother becomes very, very powerful in the dark arts. And Arion sacrificed himself to save his father. And then Arion was turned into pure energy, goes off into space or something like that. Garn stays around for centuries. In fact, I think Garn showed up in a JLA issue, in fact, if I remember right.
He certainly did.
Yep. So Garn stays around for centuries. He becomes very, very powerful. And even he was going to destroy prehistoric or ancient Atlantis. Well, the father brought Arion's energy back, consolidated into a form, and that's where you get Arion, Lord of Atlantis. That's actually where the story kind of starts, is the father has brought him back, and now he's Arion, Lord of Atlantis, protecting the kingdom of ancient Atlantis. And throughout the stories, you know, his magical powers would wax and wane, and that's where this entry leaves us. Now, if you go forward from here, you know, he goes around for a little, like, I don't know, 35 issues or so. I can't remember exactly. Then in the 1990s, they do a sort of a soft reboot. They bring Arion back. We talked about this recently on the other Who's Who podcast. Arion the Immortal. In the modern day, he had that red outfit. I don't know if you remember that one. And he kind of hung around some of the books for a while. In fact, he was in a couple Aquaman issues because of the connection with Atlantis. And then in the 2000s, he made a couple appearances like in JSA and a Superman story called Camelot Falls, which I don't remember. Then, and this is news to me. Apparently he showed up in the New 52, in Secret Six and in Blue Beetle. It was like an antagonist character. Like maybe it was even a new version. I don't know. Interesting.
But I had no idea.
Yeah, but at the time this was published, Arion was issue number 29, and so the series didn't have that much longer to go. For me personally, though, so this is where I come in. The first appearance was in Warlord number 55 as one of those 8-page backups, right, in December 1981, and I bought this comic specifically for the Arion backup. I have no idea why. I don't know what drove me to do it. No clue, because I was not a comic collector at the time. I was buying the Star Wars comics, which was on issue 57, which was during that amazing David Michelinie, Walt Simonson run. But I was buying that. But I didn't consider myself a comic collector. I was buying the Star Wars comics because I was a Star Wars collector. Like, I hadn't started with Firestorm. I hadn't started with Crisis, any of that, or X-Men, anything. So I don't know what drove me to pick up this issue of Arion. But ever since then, I was fascinated by it, and I even picked up several issues of Arion as a kid. No idea why. I'm not a fantasy guy. I kind of hate fantasy, but I love this character. So he has gone on to show up in Young Justice. He's been in some video games like DC Universe Online and Scribblenauts, which was like kind of a fun game. That is Arion, Lord of Atlantis. All right, Rob, what is the randomizer?
Well, wait, hold on.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, this is like the old show. first of all, this is the second Who's Who in a row where we're talking Arion, Lord of Atlantis. What are the odds of that? And then just a couple of weeks ago, at least at the time of this recording, it was the late Joe Kubert's birthday. Mm-hmm. And in honor of that, Paul Kupperberg posted a recollection about how he was fired off his own book by the editor, the new editor that took over. And I mean, you know, Paul names names as Paul is wont to do. So I can say it here. It was Ernie Colon who took over as editor. And apparently Ernie didn't like how Paul was writing his own character. And fired Paul off the book. And so someone else wrote Arion for a couple of issues. And then Ernie, I think, either left DC or left the, I don't know what happened, why he was rotated off the book or left the company or whatever. But anyway, they handed it to Joe Kubert, who was editing. And apparently Joe Kubert got wind of, like, wait a minute, why was the guy who created the character fired off the book? And he called Paul and hired Paul back.
Oh my gosh.
And, yeah. So that's how Paul ended up on his book. But look, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but it does seem really strange to kind of say to the guy who created the character, I don't think you're getting a handle on this. Like, well, you know, what, huh? So, yeah. That's what happened. That's some of the backstage drama of Aerie on Lord of Atlantis.
That is fascinating. Oh, wow. I'm glad you had that. That's really cool. All right. So, Rob, what has the randomizer picked for us next?
All right. Next is The Brain. And this is going to be something that's, I think is going to end up being said a lot. Mm-hmm. In between on these new shows versus the old shows is that now The Brain, TV star,
right?
Brain. Back when, you know, 12 years ago, yes, they were making comic book movies. The Marvel universe was, Marvel MCU was certainly going, but there just wasn't the torrent of stuff that there is now. You know, there was no Doom Patrol TV show and things like that, and the Supergirl and all of the, oh my god, all of the Greg Berlanti universe shows.
Right,
I mean, good Lord. Because now it's like virtually, odds are that a character in Who's Who has appeared in live action in some
form. Oh, yeah.
So now we've got The Brain. It's drawn by Bill Sienkiewicz. He, of course, is an old Doom Patrol villain. It was an unknown scientist who is this genius who experiments on an ape and puts a brain inside of an ape and gives him this massive IQ. Now, by the way, the ape's name, fellow Doom Patrol villain, is Monsieur Mala, not Shag.
Monsignor
Mala, as you like to say. It's
I really do like to say it. Now that I know someone finally got through to me after telling me all the time, now I just like saying it wrong on purpose.
I mean, it is a funnier idea to have a Monsignor Mala, to, like, he's doing benedictions and stuff, you know. Peace be with you, or something like that. that kind of thing. Of course, it's drawn by Bill Sienkiewicz. It's absolutely fantastic. Just as I'm thinking of it, that might be a fun Who's Who side project to do, would be like, find artists who had their highest batting average of, like, their listings were always great kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know? Although, yeah, I mean, it might just be the usual, right? Yeah, the regular Brian Bolland, Bill
Sienkiewicz. Yeah, it's going to be Brian Bolland, Paul, Paris Cullins, Art Adams. It's going to be those kind of guys.
Still,
yeah.
I just loved every listing that Bill Sienkiewicz did, just because he just brought his weird energy to it.
Yeah.
And so we see these four panels and the surprint of the brain inside the jar, and then the giant robot, and then we see the surgery, and we see Monsieur Mamala with a scalpel in his hand, and it's even kind of like a little, not like a key, but like a little spotlight of, like, oh, here's the brain of the scalpel, and this is where it went, and this is what it took out. It's very fun. And the brain, of course, is just sitting there immobile because he looks like Superpowers Brainiac,
mm-hmm.
except he's on a pedestal and he's got this giant brain. There is the detail, though, that I love in the listing, which was, it said that after the Brotherhood of Evil, which was the group they were involved in, killed the original Doom Patrol, which we know didn't take, but at the time we thought it did.
Right.
They killed the Doom Patrol. The Brotherhood of Evil disbanded, which is really kind of funny. Like, the villains are like, well, our job here is done.
we had one mission. We accomplished it.
One mission, kill the Doom Patrol. We did it. Let's just take our W and go home. I love that they were like, we don't need to conquer the world. We just killed those four losers, and now we're happy with that. I think that's something very, very funny. So it's a great listing. Again, this is one of the reasons I loved Who's Who, is that they hired people like Bill Sienkiewicz to bring an edgier take on some of their characters. DC, even this far in, was still the more stodgy company, and they took themselves a little more seriously than Marvel did. And the Dark Knight Returns hadn't started yet, and Watchmen hadn't started yet. And they were still a little more suit and tie of a comic book company. And here they're bringing that kind of manic funniness to some of their entries. So I love this one, even though it's just a pedestal.
Right.
Sienkiewicz still brings a ton of energy to it.
Oh, yeah, and I can't – and that logo looks great, too, by the way.
Yeah.
It's got all kinds of serifs hanging off of it, and it just looks fun. And, I mean, who doesn't love a brain in a jar, right? I mean, just the concept goes back to, I don't know, the 50s or whatever. I mean, people just love this idea. Now, this particular character, I'm sorry, comes from Doom Patrol 86 from 1964. But just that whole idea of a brain in a jar is just awesome. And I can't add anything to the description of the art you did. I mean, I love the surprint because it's actually kind of two-tone. It's yellow blocks with red surprint. And right. It just looks great the way they've done it. Almost like, not postage stamps, but I mean, almost. I mean, it's four little stamp sort of things that are all scratchy and everything. Whereas the four image just is so crisp and clear. I mean, if you told me that front image was done by Perez, I'd believe you. It looks that good. And so it's just, wow, what a fun, great entry. And of course, you know, besides the brother, so I guess they decided after the Doom Patrol was destroyed, eventually they had a reunion, I guess, to go after the Teen Titans. I don't know, whatever.
Kind of fun.
So, but, you know, so I got, you mentioned as far as all the stuff that's happened since we recorded originally, but do you know when the Brain's very first, extra media appearance was? Do you, Rob Kelly, know specifically Brain's first appearance?
You're trying to hint at something, and I don't know what you're picking up. What am I supposed to know?
The Brain, according to the internet, appeared in the 1967-1968 Superman and Aquaman Adventure Hour, and the Brain was the villain in an Aquaman episode, supposedly.
No, that never happened.
Well, then there must be a Brain in a jar, and they're just crediting him to it.
Okay, then, yeah, there was never the Brain in it.
Okay.
No, that's not. I think that's a Filmation idea that somebody is ascribing to.
Okay.
To Brain, because I would know that. I've seen every episode of that show. And
right.
That's they, never, they only did a couple of Aquaman villains. They certainly never did the Brain. So.
Okay. So it must have just been a similar idea. So.
Yeah.
So he's gone on, though. Of course, he's been in the Teen Titans cartoon, Teen Titans Go, Batman Brave and the Bold, Justice League Action, My Adventures with Superman, Young Justice, and then live action.
He was in My Adventures with Superman,
that
too?
New show. Apparently, he's in there, yeah. And then live action, you mentioned Doom Patrol already. He was also in Smallville. I mean, in lots of video games. I mean, this guy is out. Cause, I mean, again, who doesn't love a brain in a jar? You know, and then there's the fun thing, too, that after this, you know, they find out that Monsignor Malat and the Brain are in love. I said Monsignor, didn't I?
You said it again.
I didn't mean that was accidental. Monsieur Malat and the Brain are in love. And it's just the idea of a hyperintelligent ape and a brain in a jar being in love with each other is just hysterically funny. So, they're always going to keep showing up. They've shown up in all the New 52 and Rebirth and all that as well. Now, at the time of this publication, this was, by the way, this came from issue number 3 of Who's Who. The last time the Brain had appeared, I think was about 22 months before this in New Teen Titans number 31. So there we go.
All right.
By the way, if you want more on the Brain, you should check out the Waiting for Doom podcast. Mm-hmm. All right, next, the randomizer has for us from issue number 5 of Who's Who, we have Cyborg by George Perez and Romeo Tengal, and what a hell of an entry. So you've got Cyborg in the foreground. You know, this is right at the peak of New Teen Titans popularity here. I mean, let's see. They are on issue 10 of the Baxter series of Teen Titans, so they are just at the top of popularity. So in the foreground, again, it's Victor Stone. A surprint in the back. So they've got an image of him holding up a rock, him blasting with his white noise generator. But then across the top, they have these 5 images, which are so disturbing. It is Victor Stone on the left, just as a normal kid. Then it shows his skull, and a good, I don't know, 1/3 of his skull has just been erased or scratched off because of his accident. And then in the next 2 panels, you see it being rebuilt with cybernetic technology. And the last image is how he looks now. I mean, it just really sends home the horror of this disfigurement that he suffers from, the rebuilding of the skull. Oh my gosh. And then, and the logo, I believe that logo probably came from Tales of the Teen Titans. But, so what do you think of the art here?
Oh, come on. George Perez in his prime. Rest in peace, by the way. I guess we should say George Perez, doing New Teen Titans. I mean, come on. Yeah.
One of his signature characters.
So one of the characters that he was involved with creating. I mean, again, we know Cyborg's a movie star now.
Jeez,
not as much of a movie star as they had planned, but nevertheless, he was in a movie and, also with a toy, of course. You know, he was
lots of toys though.
Lots of toys, superpowers and everything else. So, by the way, I know someone that actually has the superpower Cyborg figure.
Oh, cool.
Which is amazing. Chuck Dill, frequent guest on the network, actually has one. So, by the way, I told him to watch out for Chris Franklin if he ever shows up at his house. this is everything you want out of, this is what you're hoping for. This is your thing, you know?
I was reading an article where someone interviewed George Perez, and he did say, and I guess I didn't know this, but innately, I guess I did. I don't know. He said that when he was designing Cyborg, it was visually inspired by the character of Deathlok. And you can really see it in the face.
Sure.
And like, yeah, you really, really can. He said it was a combination of Deathlok and a young Jim Brown, who's a famous football player and civil rights activist and actor. So that's what he was going for. So, so you brought up how well he's known. So I'm going to ask you here. Are we at the point, and I think we might be, where Cyborg is a household name?
No, I wouldn't say household. I wouldn't go that far. No, I would not go that far.
All the kids that grew up watching the Teen Titans and Teen Titans Go show?
I guess maybe I'm quibbling over the idea of household. I don't think he's, to me, Spider-Man, household.
Superman, sure, okay, yeah.
Cyborg,
yeah.
Not that level. He's not at that level, but he's certainly way more known than he ever would have been. I think part of it is the name is so generic. Cyborg is like, well, that's a robot, right? Like, it's Spider-Man is Spider-Man. It's only, you know, that's only one thing. So I don't think a cyborg is to that level, but certainly, I mean, good Lord, he's got I'm sure an imprint on people through multimedia that he never had when we did this entry the first time.
Yeah, so I would say if you're looking at like recognition, your A level is going to be your Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, right? Then your B level is going to be like probably Scarlet Witch and maybe Harlequin, you know, and things like that. And I would say he's right, like B minus or C level then, you know, because again, the kids all growing up know who he is. Our generation may not, but the kids do, because they all are familiar with Teen Titans. Even if they didn't watch it, they know it. I mean, think about it. Justice League movie, Teen Titans Go, Doom Patrol, Super Friends, Smallville, Young Justice, gazillion action figures, gazillion video games. I mean, he's really out there. So. Now, real quick, the text here. So I got to assume that Marv Wolfman wrote this text, because it is lovely. I mean, it is really one of the best written pieces I've read so far. It really tells the story about Victor, and you really feel for him. It talks about his parents were Star Lab scientists, how this interdimensional portal opens, this creature comes through, kills his mother, wounds his father, nearly kills him. Of course, the father rebuilds him, and he's resentful towards his father. The story we all know, but it's really well written. That doesn't always happen, so I was very impressed. Yeah, and we talked. Oh, go ahead.
No, we talked about this. Some, I don't know. Did Cyborg get a listing in the Who's Who in the Loose Leaf edition?
Yeah, but it was. He was like mostly robotic at that point, because that was the storyline that was going on.
Well, maybe that's when I brought it up. But I mean, it's, yeah. I read New Teen Titans. You read New Teen Titans, right? You read it when it was originally out.
Well, not originally. No, but later.
Oh no, okay. I read it when it came out. I bought it off the stands. And you know, one of the whole motif of Cyborg is that he's like, oh my god, I'm a monster, and he's out on the street, and he's got to like wear like a hoodie or a cap, because if people see him, they're like, ugh. And you know, it's interesting to think about that was a trope. Not, I don't mean that in a negative way, but that was a story beat that you would naturally follow back then. But nowadays, not so much. I mean, look, if someone had this level of mechanical parts, yes, they would certainly catch some stares, no doubt. But we have all adjusted to people with mechanical legs or mechanical arms or mechanical, you know, appendages of some way. And you don't stare at them unless you're a monster. I mean, we've accepted that and learned, not accepted. We've learned to, that is not an unusual thing anymore. And it is not something where it is a subject of pity or fear and that's a good thing. Like, you know, we've actually made some positive strides in this case, at least, that if you saw someone with a robot arm reaching for a cup at Starbucks, you wouldn't be like, oh my God, what is that freak? You would just be like, okay. And that's fantastic. And so it's great that we as a society have moved past the story idea that Vic Stone could not go out in public and not be harassed.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. That's because that was very much his MO. Even in the Super Friends cartoon, that was the biggest thing, was he always wore the hoodie and was hiding himself. By the way, and moving away from that, but you made a great point there. So we are only 5 months away when this entry came out in issue number five from him appearing in the Superpowers cartoon, which I think that was the first step in really elevating his profile. He went from being New Teen Titans to being in every kid's, you know, TV set, which is amazing. And at this point, you know, the character was only 5 years old. I mean, that's amazing to me.
It's fun to think how big they became. Yeah.
After 5 years, he was already on Super Friends and became, you know, a pretty big deal. That's amazing. So other stuff on this one is just sadly there, and we've said this before, this is not new, but there is no like epic cyborg story you can point to. There's no like, oh, Batman Year One, that's great. Or, you know, or Superman, the man of, whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow. There is no cyborg story to go, ooh, that one. And unfortunately, his best moments are always with the Teen Titans. So it's, I wish the people have given him ongoing series. And if someone wants to tell me in the comments, there's a particular run of his own ongoing series that was amazing, I'd love to know, because I think he's a cool character. So if you want more on him, you know, check out all those things, but you could also listen to the Pop David, Pop Culture Affidavit or the Titan Up Defense podcasts. All right, Rob, so what does the randomizer have for it? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm doing this one, aren't I?
Boop, 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 boop.
So the randomizer for us next, from issue number 10, we have Harlequin, but probably not the one you're expecting. So back then, before we had Harley Quinzel, we had Molly Scott, the Harlequin. So this is the Golden Age Harlequin, drawn by Marty Nodell and Dick Giordano. Great combination there. So she is there in her very much, you know, female clown court jester kind of outfit with the ruffles skirt and the crazy legs and the pointy shoes and the hat and just, you know, crazy clown sort of outfit.
Very impractical costume.
Yes. And she's holding a mandolin. And then in the surprint, she is blasting Alan Scott with some eye beams. And then there's a like sort of a beauty shot of her with her mask off. You can see how pretty she is. And then she's smashing a, looks like a hoodlum or a crook with her mandolin. So what do you think of this one?
Well, she's going to break out into REM's Losing My Religion at any moment, which is very exciting. Look, I'm going to go art wise. This is the opposite end of the thing I was talking about with the Sienkiewicz brain listing, is that using Bill Sienkiewicz, a modern artist with a modern style on an old character, was one of the things I loved about Who's Who. This is the opposite of that, but also in a good way, is that they are going back and pulling an artist, Martin Nodell, who drew the original Green Lantern, the 1940s Golden Age, and getting him to do this listing from a character from his era. I'm sure Martin Odell at this point was mostly retired. He did do a couple of things in All-Star Squadron every so often. And I was only vaguely aware of who that was, but I grew more familiar thanks to this listing, because then I would look him up and be like, oh, this is the guy that did the original Green Lantern. And I loved that they did that. And so DC was simultaneously looking back and looking forward. And again, that's one of the reasons why I love this series so much. And why, even though I've gotten rid of all of my tens of thousands of comics I used to have, I still have all my Who's Who's. I still have them because they mean that much to me. So I love this character. Again, the costume is goofy as all get out. You know, I mean, just come on. I mean, God forbid if she drops some change, she can't reach over to grab it because she's got that ruffle around her. But nevertheless, it's a character that really hadn't appeared much, probably in decades for the most part, but she was still part of the DC history. And I love that they gave her a listing.
Well, and I love that, like you mentioned, the original art or the classic artists, because at this point, a lot of them were being phased out because DC was going into the crisis, post-crisis era, and they were trying to push new ground and, quite frankly, stealing a bunch of Marvel creators, too. And so it wasn't those kind of people weren't going to get as much work. So this was a great opportunity to still throw him some work, which was wonderful. And Marty Nodell, I met him in 1995. He came to the store I was working at, and he did a signing when Green Lantern number 50 came out, which was when Kyle Rayner became Green Lantern. And he did a signing in our store, and he just there all day. And I chatted with him and his wife. He was lovely. I bought an original sketch of Alan Scott from him. So I've got an original
sketch. Oh,
that's
great.
Yeah. Keep it hanging on my wall. And they were such a lovely group, a couple, and they were so nice. So it just makes me very happy to see this. Now, interestingly, Marty didn't create Harlequin. So I looked this up. Harlequin was actually created by Robert Kaniger and Irwin Hansen. Hazen, sorry. So in All American Comics number 89 in 1947. So I guess Marty wasn't drawing the book at that point, but you know, it still makes sense for him to do the character. So the story behind this is she was Alan Scott's secretary, right? And she had a crush on Green Lantern, not on Alan, but on Green Lantern. But Green Lantern told her he was too busy fighting crime to be involved in romance. So she became a criminal to get his attention because, you know, that's what you do. And she ended up battling him a number of times. Eventually she quit. Retired and went on to do her own thing. But then years later in Infinity Inc. So part of the reason she's in this entry is because she is back at this point, the same time as Who's Who number 10. She is a current character in Infinity Inc. because she is reconnected with Alan and they've gotten married. And so, So at this point, she's in love with him, and they've been married, which is great. In fact, when Who's Who number 10 is on the shelves, the same time as this entry, that same month, Infinity Inc. annual number 1 gets published, which is where Thorn is revealed as Jade and Obsidian's mother. So kind of the connection with the stepmom and the real mom and that whole thing. Now, I don't expect you to remember this, but in the 90s, they aged Alan Scott down. They made him young again, like young. Not like a little kid, but, you know, in his prime. And Molly was this older lady, and she was struggling being like, oh my gosh, my husband's this young, youthful guy, and I'm this old lady. So when the Underworld Unleashed stories came out where people were making deals with the devil, she made a deal with Neron to make her young as well. Well, this resulted in a very 1990s version of Harlequin. It didn't last very long, but it was it was very much an updating of the character. It didn't get us to where we would get with, of course, Joker's Harlequin, but it was DC. I've said this on a bunch of podcasts. DC was really chasing that Harlequin female trickster kind of character for years. And that was just another example of it. And you and I talked about her recently, believe it or not. You may not remember, but we did the new Golden Age special.
Oh, right.
There was all these retconned characters that were like supposedly erased from history and were now reinserted. They were newly created, but they're saying they're being reintegrated to history. And one of them is Harlequin's son. I mean, that's the character's name, Harlequin's son, who was originally an idea for Infinity Inc. that never panned out. So yeah, there's a character running around now that is obviously the son of Molly. We don't know who the father is. It'd be interesting to find that out at some point. And the other thing too is, you know, they've recently revealed that Alan Scott is gay, and he's been in the closet for decades, and he's finally had the courage to come out of the closet. So I guess that means Molly and him probably aren't together anymore, which makes me sad, but hopefully I hope they remain friends. I hope she kind of stays on as a supporting character in some capacity, because she was his support structure for so many years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if you want more on Harlequin, you can check out some JSA related podcasts, such as our own JSA Presents, or Earth 2 podcast, or World on Fire. Or the Lantern Cast, I'm sure, has probably done something about her as well.
One thing I want to mention is, you know, I'm a stickler for this, is the completely improbable height-weight ratios that DC loves to do. And here it says Molly is 5'7", 120. Now, that's still very thin, because 5'7 is much taller than the average woman is.
Oh, yeah.
But that's at least a somewhat achievable proportion.
No,
I mean, for
no,
someone who's a...
Actually, it's not. No.
Well, all right. It's not that bad. It's still pretty far gone, but it's not that bad. I mean, later on in the series, especially the loose leaf, it would get like, oh, Lady Shiva is 6'1", 112. You're like, no, wait a minute. You know, so I mean, okay, you know, Harley Quinn in her prime was in really, really good shape, and she managed to be 5'7", 120. Again, it's not really hardly achievable, but it's within the realm of human possibility, unlike some later listings.
I won't quite agree with you, but yeah, it's closer than many others. I'll give you that.
That's what I mean to say.
Okay. Fair enough. Absolutely. All right. The randomizer up next. Boop, 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 boop. From issue number 11, we get Icicle, drawn by Paris Cullins and Carl Kiesel.
Green Lantern again.
And this piece is gorgeous. Oh, you're right. Yeah. So you've got, in the foreground, you've got, and it's kind of hard to tell the surprint from that because he's all just white, you know, with black ink, but, it's him holding his freeze gun and he's kind of like in dramatic pose. And you see, I love the icicle sort of pants. Like there it looks like icicles being grown in the wind. I don't know. But then in the surprint, which is all blue, he's got him shooting Alan Scott and freezing him in a block of ice. You got him with a gun. You see a close-up of him with his mask off. And that's something we haven't mentioned, but we used to all the time. So in the surprint, in theory, you're supposed to see the character's face without their mask. That's part of the deal with the surprint in the original Who's Who. So you see Dr. Yor Makent without his mask on, and he's got like a test tube, and he looks all evil. And my favorite part of this is all around the edges with the surprint, Paris Cullins has drawn an icy border, like there's icicles all the way around the edge of the image, and it looks awesome.
It's a great touch. It's a really great touch.
This thing looks so cartoony, like in like the best possible way. You know, the action looks cartoony. The face of the evil doctor looks so cartoony. I love this piece so much. It looks great. So getting into the details of it. So this is the original Icicle, not his son. You know, at this point is, I love the occupation, former physicist, now professional criminal. So he was a European inventor. He fakes his own death. What he does is by faking his own death, he actually kills this gangster. And this is the part I don't get. I love how they kind of glaze over at the entry, but like somehow his cold gun temporarily disguised the dead guy as himself. You just go with it. Okay. So he's a reoccurring Green Lantern foe. He joins the Injustice Society of the World, Crime's Champions. He died in Crisis. And 1 year from this point, when issue number 11 of Who's Who was out, Icicle 2, his son, would be introduced to Infinity Inc. Now, here's the thing that blew my mind. I did a little extra research on this one. Now, I can't promise you I'm right, but I did the best I could. It's a little harder to research certain things nowadays. But he first appeared in All-American Comics number 90 in 1947. He only had 3 Golden Age appearances. So, and then in the Silver Age, he starts showing up again. But only, like, as a character that I feel like was like a frequent enemy of the Justice Society, only 3 appearances. Really surprised me.
Yeah, I would not have guessed that.
So this guy, I don't know how much you know about what he's been doing in other media. He's a big star. Like the Stargirl TV show, he was like the lead villain for a whole season. I know.
You hear yourself.
I know. He's in Young Justice. He was in Smallville. He was in the Flash. Kind of. I mean, they had an Icicle. It wasn't quite him, but video games, DVD movies, all this stuff. I really think that he is a great design. I love that Icicle 2 just kind of basically picked up and said, you know what? He's so good. We're just going to keep him going. He's like almost identical look and everything for a long time. He's a really sharp looking character. And Paris Collins, just, I absolutely love this image. I just think it looks gorgeous.
His freeze gun with this big disc on the top mm-hmm. of it. There was a toy that used to be advertised in the back of 70s comics. And it was, I don't know what you put in it, but like you fired it and it like shot, I think like discs.
Yeah, like little mini frisbees or discs.
Yeah, that's what his gun looks like to me. It's this little like new from Idea. Like, and I also, it makes me wonder, Mudpack style, have all the DC Freeze guys like banded together to form a team? They should have, right? Icicle, Mr. Freeze. Captain Cold, you know, like get the all together and they can like freeze the world or something. I don't know.
I've definitely read a story or two where they were hanging out, because I remember Killer Frost was hanging out with them.
Killer Frost, that's another one. There you go. Yeah. The four of them, right. Just those four together.
I don't think they made a team or anything, but they should. They absolutely should.
The Ice Cubes or something.
Right. Like yeah, perfect. So again, you know, if you want more, it's a JSA character. So you can check out the JSA Presents, the Earth 2 Podcast, or World on Fire. All right, Rob.
All right.
What do we have next?
Yeah, my turn. Maxi Zeus from first appeared in Detective Comics 483. Most people at this point knew him from his recent appearances in Batman and the Outsiders. He's drawn here by Trevor Von Eden and Dick Giordano. I love Trevor Von Eden. I don't think this is necessarily one of like his best listings in the world. I think the pose is a little kind of boring. I love all the surprint stuff. That's great. I love Batman squaring off with the team of villains that he's got there, and he got Maxi Zeus, and you know, and he's got, it says occupation gang leader. So he's got it, and he has an unnamed wife and a daughter, and he's a member of the team, the New Olympians. Mike Barr really tried to make new super teams, super villain teams happen in Batman and the Outsiders. It was Force of July and the Masters of Disaster. He really was big on villain teams, and I don't know if it really worked.
They're all themed. That's the beauty of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, Maxi Zeus, he says he's one of the most, I love this. He's one of the most respected gang leaders in Gotham City, which is, I love that there's so many.
Right.
Like there's a pecking order, you know, he's like, you don't want to work for the Joker. Cause if like you piss him off, he's going to poison you and dump you in the river. But Maxi Zeus, not so bad, but it's a guy who thinks he is the modern incarnation of the Greek god Zeus. So like, oh, okay. That's how his particular, monomania, as it says, you know, why the hell that got started. Never one of the big villains. I'm sure that post Who's Who, he probably made a bunch of appearances. God, he's probably, you know, probably heads up some TV show that I don't know about on the CW network. But again, I remember him from his appearances in Batman and the Outsiders.
That's where I remembered him from too. Like as a kid, I remember the Batman and the Outsiders was always at the convenience store. So I'd see those covers and those Olympics ones hung around for a while, I guess. So the whole idea there was he had a daughter named Medea and he attacked the 1984 Olympics. The whole idea is he was trying to coerce a Greek athlete to adopt his daughter. I don't know that that's really the way to go about it, but I mean, hey, if it works for anybody, I guess. And apparently before becoming a nut job, he was a professor of Greek history or culture or something like that. So maybe that's where his fixation came from. Now about the art, I just want to say, like, I love each piece that Trevor has drawn individually.
Yes.
It's just collectively together. It looks like he just did 4 sketches on separate sheets of paper and they cut and pasted them together. It just, it's not a cohesive thing.
Yes.
Which is what's disappointing.
Yeah.
And I like him cradling a Medea at the bottom. I mean, it looks great. So, by the way, this was in Who's Who issue number 15, worth noting. And he really, up to this point, he'd only made a handful of appearances before being in the Outsiders.
I love that it mentions he's residing in the minimum security wing
of
Arkham Asylum, which is, I love that. Like, imagining in the annals of Arkham Asylum, like, those guys are considered the prison punks of Arkham Asylum, that they're in minimum security. Meanwhile, you know, over here, the bad guys, the Killer Croc and Joker and, you know, Two-Face. And then down here is Kite Man and Maxi Zeus.
Right.
And the Bouncer and the King, you know, all those guys.
Signalman and all that.
Yeah, Signalman.
You can really get a miniseries out of that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. They let those guys out and have forks and stuff. So anyway.
Well, you know, Grant Morrison did the Arkham Asylum graphic novel. And in there, you know, Batman's trapped in the asylum and he keeps bumping into other people. And Maxie was in there and it was, I don't remember the details of it, but it was like disturbing what he did with Maxie Zeus.
Yeah.
And it was just, I remember it was like as a kid, I was like, whoa, that's a guy from Outsiders. So if you are looking for more Maxie Zeus, you can check out Batman the Animated Series. He was there. He was in a show called The Batman. He's also appeared in Harlequin several times, which is the funniest damn show, by the way, and video games and stuff like that. And if you want to hear about him in podcasts, you can, of course, check out The Overlooked Dark Knight, The Batpod, or our buddy Tim Price does The Outcasters, where he talks all about Batman and the Outsiders. So you could check that out as well. And you notice this one doesn't have a lot of text. And I remembered as I was looking at this was that's one thing you and I discovered years ago was that the Outsiders entries tended to not have a lot of text, tended to really be heavy on the art. Because most of it was Jim Aparo at that point. But I think this is probably one of those they handed off to Mike W. Barr, and he just kind of, again, kept it small.
All right. So next up, is from issue 17 of Who's Who, OSS Agents.
Woo!
Drawn by Rick Estrada. They first appeared in GI Combat, at least a couple of the team did, and then a couple of the members. And then later on, they would add other members across different issues. And then they had another appearance in Showcase number 104, which I believe is the final issue of Showcase before it was canceled.
Oh.
Now, I don't remember whether by the time of our recording, I was on the Rick Estrada train. I am now. When I was a kid, I did not like his art at all. I thought it was too cartoony. I just didn't like it. And then as I got older, I started looking at it and seeing it in other contexts. I'm like, I love this stuff. Why didn't I like this in the beginning? That's really weird. I don't know why, you know, but I absolutely love it. So in between when we first covered this listing back in again, issue, episode 17, and now I have read some OSS agent storyline.
Oh, no way.
Yes. I bought some random GI combats for my spinner rack, and some of them had OSS agent strips in them. And I've read the Showcase, and they're a lot of fun. I mean, this team was formed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So right there, I'm already on your side. this is the second most famous team in DC Comics formed by FDR.
Oh my.
And the whole bit is that they're just undercover spies. You know, that's the whole bit of it.
But before we get too far and people start writing in, I mean, we do know that the OSS was real. When we say FDR formed it, it was real from 1942 to 1945.
Yeah, the Office of Strategic Services. That's a real thing. Yes, yes.
Yeah, they had 13,000 employees, and it was eventually succeeded by the CIA. So, yes.
Right. You got the members named, the head guys named Control, and you've got Dina, Falcon, Fleur, and Sorcerer, who actually does not look like what he's named. And the drawing, you've got Control, and he's literally doing like a puppet master thing where he's got the strings on them, which isn't, I don't know if that's exactly the image you really want to present. Like, he's kind of like evil and he's controlling them. I mean, I know his name is Control, mm-hmm. but it's, to me, has a slightly more sinister cast to it than I had, at least when I read in the strips. But they got Rick Estrada to draw this, and I love it. It has a very Alex Toth energy. I know I tend to use that as a compliment for every artist that I like, and it's kind of a, you know, Rick Estrada had his own style. But I don't know. I read them, and I was like, these are really fun. Why didn't, I don't know. And again, I love that DC was trying to still, I don't know, not make this a thing. But by this point, GI Combat, I think, was just about to be canceled. And well, so, right?
So, they first appear in GI Combat number 192.
Right.
Then they get 50 more appearances.
Yeah. Yeah, they were a regular feature. Yeah.
Across 80 issues of GI Combat. So this was 1976. GI Combat, at least their run in GI Combat, went all the way to 1984. So, it went 8 years in that book, off and on.
Right, but I mean, G.I. Combat, the book, didn't have much life left in it by 1985.
Well, yes. By 1985, the strip had been over for 2 years. Yes, the OSS strip had been done by two. When this issue, number 17, hit, the book had been off for 2 years. So
That's what I meant. And also the G.I. Combat, the book, mm-hmm. was almost done.
Yeah.
I think it probably was
by this point. Yeah. Cause yeah. This is 17 issues into it. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, there's still, you know, the war features of DC Comics are all going away except for Sergeant Rock. It's the only one that would still last. But by the mid 80s, all the war books of Unknown Soldier, Weird War Tales, G.I. Combat, they're all going away. And so that, again, this was something that I loved about Who's Who, is that they were showing you some feature that didn't have any current parlance, but current currency, I should say. But you know, it was still a thing. They were still using it here and there, and I love that they got a whole page.
It's great too. He got a whole half page up for the drawing at the top, and I love like the image. We're suckers for the little heads on the side, you know, just like JLA used to do. So I love the control is at the top, and his scarf is part of the design element going all the way down through the characters' heads. You know, it's great there. I love the marionette feature. The logo looks great the way it's worked in with all and the surprint is just like stars and swastikas and stuff. Nothing important for the surprint, but it just looks stellar. Looks fantastic. And, you know, Control is interesting. I was reading about here. So the whole reason he got the job is because he was on a mission with his wife. And rather than give up top secret information, he allowed her to be killed. And so they said, well, okay, if he's willing to put his own agents at risk and allow them to die, then he's our man. That's how he got the job, promoted to Control because he let his wife die. And then there's one more major member who doesn't get in the image, but is mentioned in the text, which is Kana, the Shadow Warrior.
Yeah.
And the reason they don't get in the image is because they have their own entry later on in the case. Or that's, I guess, right. By this point, it was earlier in the case, but that's wild.
Yep. Yeah. It's really fun. And again, I like the stories quite a bit, and so it's kind of weird to me that they were in the last issue of Showcase, even though they were in G.I. Combat at the time. Like, I thought Showcase was sort of the idea of the book was we're trying out new features, and why did they get their own issue of Showcase when they already had their own book? You know, they already had their own place to appear. But nevertheless, it's really fun. I really enjoyed it, and so. Every so often, like I said, I would pick up a G.I. Combat and get it at a comic store for cheap and put it on the spinner rack. And a couple of them have OSS, and they're really fun. They're really terrific. So
created by Robert Kaniger and Rick Estrada. And just, I mean, Robert Kaniger's name has come up a few times already, and it's just amazing how much work he did. Now, if you want more on them, you can listen to the Task Force X podcast because they did roll some of the OSS elements into Task Force X later on.
All right. So next up is everyone's favorite Prince Rahman, Mind Master. You pour some hot water into him and you basically have a superhero in just a couple of minutes, and it's very cheap. He's every college student's favorite superhero. No, Prince Rahman is AKA Mark Merlin. And if you read his entry, which is very boring, but if you read his entry, you will see that this was a character that was a concept of, it was a specific concept. And then they clearly decided a ways in, we got to kind of juice this up a little bit. So then he becomes Prince Rahman. He first appears as Mark Merlin in House of Secrets 23, but he doesn't become Rahman until House of Secrets 73. So there was a whole bunch of issues where he's having these adventures as Mark Merlin, who's kind of this guy that gets roped into his uncle's world of magic, and there's this kind of nefarious group of magicians, the Council of Three, and he gets involved, and then he ends up later on gaining superpowers and becoming more of a superhero. So you can sort of see the trajectory of superheroes are becoming the big thing. And so this feature that was probably relatively dullsville to most readers at the time, we gotta jazz this up a little. So let's turn him into a superhero halfway through.
Well, they were very specifically, I read, trying to rip off Doctor Strange. This happens 2 years after Doctor Strange
hit the
scene.
Exactly.
And you can even see in the look like, oh, yeah, I can totally see that.
He's got the medallion. He's got the cape. He's got, he's drawn by Alex Saviak and Joe Giella. And of course, they gave him a whatever happened to feature, yes, which yes, we covered on what show were we doing those on?
It was our regular Aquaman and Firestorm show. Was it? Actually. Yeah.
Why were we doing those on Aquaman?
It's because it was the only show we had for a long time.
Well, I guess so. All right. Yeah. That's why we just shoved everything into that banana.
Yes, we did.
Didn't we? But anyway, that's his whole big. You read that. And I've never read a Mark Merlin or Prince Rahman story. I will say the initial concept of him getting involved in his uncle's world of magic, and there's this whole nefarious group, that actually sounds pretty cool. I like that. I think that that sounds fun. And then when he becomes the superhero, then I go, oh, all right, that, all right. Now I don't know how long he lasted as Prince Rahman at that point, but it does sound a lot less interesting to me when they're trying to forcing him into becoming a superhero.
I think the only reason this entry even made it into Who's Who is because he had been in that Whatever Happened To segment recently. Cause I mean, he's a forgotten character, right? I mean, yeah. He shows up in Crisis for like a panel and things like that. And I mean, since then they brought him back like one time for Reign in Hell. So he's barely even a footnote in history. But I will tell you, I was reading this entry in preparation for this episode. I fell asleep reading it two different times and it had to wake. I mean, not just like, you know, oh, I'm bored, like genuinely. Snoring and things like that. So I couldn't wrap my brain around this. I'm like, what? They changed the character halfway through? So I went ahead and found House of Secrets number 73. And I don't know. I don't want to say I read the story. I skimmed it. Let's put it that way. So I skimmed the story where he transforms. Because I was like, is this a retcon? Nope, straight up. Mark Merlin starts off the story. He tells his fiance, oh, no, run. I'm going to protect you. He gets sent off to this other dimension. And while he's there, it's crazy. Like, he's been away from his fiance for like 30 seconds. And they're like, well, you can't ever go home. So he starts making out with another chick right away. I mean, there's like no, the body's not even cold here. And
it was the 60s.
I guess so. And they tell him the only way home is to go into Rahman's body. So Mark Merlin shoves his mind into Prince Rahman's body. Somehow they send that home. So he comes home. And so he just picks up right where Mark Merlin left off, and he continues on. Like, his fiance is now his secretary. He's still in the same mansion. He's still doing all the same stuff, except he never tells anyone that he's got Mark Merlin's brain inside him. he just lets the world think he's somebody new. It's so strange that he's there side by side with his fiance from 15 minutes ago and never tells her, by the way, I was the guy you were engaged to. None of that. It's the closest analogy I can come up with is like, it's like a TV show when the lead actor leaves and they keep the show going, like Head of the Class. Howard Hessman leaves the show in like, I don't know, the fourth or fifth season, and they bring in some new, you know, guy who's supposed to be the new teacher in the classroom. It's like that. You know, it's like the same trappings, but a new lead, or Blue's Clues. Maybe that's better, because like this little puppy lives in the house, and every so often some new dude just lives in the house and keeps the story going. That's kind of what this feels like.
All right. Anyway. Fair enough.
This was from issue 18 of Who's Who, by the way, we should say.
Yes.
All right, up next is from issue 20, Saturn Queen. So here we go, Rob. The randomizer has brought us our first Legionnaires character. Congratulations.
But hey, there's color at least.
It's not all gray and drab. So this is art by Dan Jurgens and Bob Ochsner. And so what you've got here is, it's imagine Saturn Girl grown up with red hair and evil, and that's kind of what you have here. So it's very similar to the Saturn Girl outfit, except it's all in dark blues. She's got red hair. She's doing a little Brokeback pose where you get to see her butt and her boobs in the same shot. The surprint in the background, you have a very beautiful image of her face. You've got her and her companion. So she's, rather than Saturn Girl, she's Saturn Queen. And then rather than Lightning Boy, you've got Lightning Lad. I mean, you've got Lightning Lord. And rather than Cosmic Kid, you've got Cosmic King. And they're blasting Superboy. So they're fighting Superboy there. You see her blasting Chameleon Boy in the background. You see the shuttle Tydirion from Return of the Jedi going towards a planet. and so it's, you know, again, the idea here is that these are older versions of the people that formed the Legion, not doppelgangers, not clones, but they're just similar enough. You know, again, Saturn Queen, Saturn Girl thing kind of thing. And all three of those come from the future. And they come back in time to fight the Legion of Superheroes. In fact, they call themselves a Legion of Supervillains. So, before I get into any more details, what do you think of the image?
Oh, it's very nice. It's very, they're a good combo, Jurgens and Ochsner. It's a great design. I love Jurgens' use of the negative space that her black turtleneck is kind of forming this shape, and then she kind of then she's popping out like on the left hand side. Like, yeah, it's very, very elegantly designed. Kind of like we were talking about with the Maxi Zeus, how that piece doesn't really hang together. It's just kind of three random images. This is a bunch of other random images, but it's just very well laid out. Like, it's very well designed.
Yeah. It hangs together very nicely. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. So at this point, at the time of Who's Who number 20 was on the shelves, Legion of Superheroes number 27 from the Baxter series was going, which, interestingly enough, is the same time that Man of Steel number 1 gets published. So the same month this is on the shelf, Superboy is being erased from history. And yet here he is, you know, as a Legion. So he's a relic of pre-crisis at this point, and they're still trying to figure out what to do with that. So that'll take a few years before they figure all that out. So if you want more information, of course, you can check out the Legion of Super Bloggers. And yeah, that's all I really have on her. So yeah, again, Dan Jurgens was drawing Legion about this time, so it makes sense for him to do the entry.
All right. So next up is we have our double page, our first double page spread, The Secret Society of Supervillains.
Woohoo!
Drawn by Alex Savick and Mike DiCarlo. Again, I hope Alex Savick got more than his standard page rate for drawing like 50 characters and then all the heads and stuff. This was such an interesting idea that DC tried, was to give a villain team their own book. Now, of course, they had sort of done that. The Joker had his own comic very briefly in the 70s, and Marvel tried Supervillain Team Up, which is just basically who can we team up with Namor every month. But the Secret Society of Supervillains as a series was kind of an interesting concept because it was one ongoing story.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so, I mean, you know, you could sort of think of it as, I mean, it's been collected since then, but it's kind of like, you know, that was a little ahead of the curve in terms of they didn't do single issue stories. It was one kind of ongoing thing with all these characters. And some of the villains are morts. I know we've been told by somebody not to use that term, but we didn't make it up. And then, you've got like, you know, Quake Master, Silver Ghost. There are some villains that are not quite so impressive, but then you've also got Lex Luthor and Felix Faust and Darkseid and, you know, and Psycho Pirate and Poison Ivy and Star Sapphire. So you got some real heavy hitters. I only ever had one issue.
Oh, okay.
Society of Supervillains, number 15. I don't know how I ended up getting it.
I think it's the last issue, isn't it?
I don't know. But what I love about it is there's a part in it. I think it was all, they were all written by Bob Rozakis.
Oh, no, they weren't.
No, they weren't? Okay.
Go ahead. No,
anyway, the issue I think I read was written by Bob Rozakis. Anyway, there's this great moment where they're talking about recruiting some more villains, and they have these little pictures, and it was, one of them was Quake Master, and then another was the Seismatic Twins.
Oh my God, I can't believe it. Okay, we have the same note. Go ahead.
Okay, and there's this thing where the villains are commenting, and they're like, I don't know. I think these guys are kind of losers, which I always thought was really funny that in the hierarchy, even supervillains are like, yeah, like these guys, you know, I don't know.
The Seismatic Twins get mentioned in the text, but they don't rate the picture, which cracks me up.
Oh my God. They look like just two kind of robots or something. I don't know what they ever were.
I had to look them up because I'd never even heard of them. They come from Teen Titans and they teamed up with Two-Face one time. But anyway, go ahead.
Of course they did. But anyway, you've got all these, you've got them all ganged up in one picture. Some of them are doing some body language. You've got Professor Zoom actually kind of just standing there with his arms folded, looking kind of, you know, yeah, what are you going to do about it? And then you've got Luthor and Grodd, and it's a great list.
I love that Zoom is leaning against like the panel border.
Yes.
He's using it like a wall, which is great.
Yep. And you got Blockbuster, Killer Moth. It's a fun listing. I actually would probably want to go back and read those. They're probably a lot of fun.
Well, I own them in collected edition. I bought the collections of both, so I have both the trades on those. And so here's where the series is amazing, but also not so great. So the amazing thing is, yes, the villains and the leader of the team is constantly rotating. Like, it starts off as formed by Darkseid, but then he dies over in JLA, right? So then it's Funky Flashman, or no, he died in, either way, he died, right, in the 70s. So then Funky Flashman leads it for a while, and then Gorilla Grodd leads it for a while, and then the Wizard leads it for a while, and then Ultra Humanite leads it for a while. So the leader rotates constantly, the team rotates constantly, and the downfall of the series was that the writers and artists rotated constantly. So like Jerry Conway actually kicked it off with issue one, But it just, the writers just kept changing. And so even though it had one through line of a story, you know, when you change writers that much, it's hard for it to continue. They did something interesting to avoid getting in trouble with the Comics Code, which was starting in issue 2, they introduced Captain Comet
right.
as a reoccurring character so that there was at least a hero in the book every month. And he was always battling them, trying to stop them. And I'm shocked that I didn't know that until much, much later, because Captain Comet was like, I didn't even know who that was until the acronym Legion series started. So it's kind of interesting that they try to make him a thing in the 70s, you know, it's, stop making fetch try to happen or whatever it is. But, so a couple things. And then once their series is canceled, the implosion, of course, we get that awesome JLA JSA crossover, right? The Perez drawn crossover with the Secret Society secret villains. You know, that's the one with Killer Frost, and they have those great covers and everything. But so they're created in 1976. 2 years later is the Legion of Doom. Now, I know this isn't the very first supervillain team ever created, but I do gotta wonder if the Secret Society of supervillains inspired the Legion of Doom.
I think that's reasonable.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. Okay. I think it makes sense.
I love that idea. So, and you hit on something I want to talk about, which is I love that, you know, they're going to take over the world, right? With people like Angleman. Or Captain Boomerang.
Stingray.
Yeah, exactly. Hijack. You know, Killer Moth.
Hijack. That was the other one. Yes. That was one of the other ones they mentioned. Yes.
So if you don't know who Hijack is, he is one of the, isn't he from the Royal Flush Gang?
I mean, he looks like he is, but he wasn't though.
I always assumed he was like one of them that broke off and did his own.
I guess he had to have and changed his name because the Royal Flush Gang were always just the names of the cards. There was right. no, Hi, Jack. It was just Jack. So I'm assuming, I guess that's Jack and he's changed his name or something. I don't know.
Someone let us know in the comments. There we go, folks. There's your first assignment. So again, these guys, yeah, if you want more of them, you can check out, of course, the Justice League cartoon had them in there and then Justice League Unlimited. They've been in video games and there hasn't been a ton of Secret Society supervillains. There's been a million supervillain teams that seem to be echoes of this team. So that's fair. But if you want more, you can also, of course, check out Chris and Cindy's JLU cast for a discussion about that.
By the way, I will mention that the issue that I mentioned was, in fact, the last issue. So the first one I bought was the only one I could ever get. And it was written by Bob Rozakis. So
okay, get that there we go. Right. So 16 was going to be published, but it was the beginning of a story. And so they actually asked him with the implosion. They said, look, don't publish 16.
Okay? Oh, right.
And so 16 and 17 both, I believe, went and canceled Comics Cavalcade. So
that's yes, that's right.
Yep. That's right. So, by the way, that was also from issue 20, same as Saturn Queen. So now we're going to move on to the next one in with the randomizer. Boop, 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 boop. Ultra. not Ultra the Multi-Alien. Oh. Sorry. Oh, just Ultra with two A's.
Damn randomizer.
So he is from issue 24 of Who's Who, drawn by Eric. So this is the dude in the purple with the long red hair from Earth Prime. So this is Eric Larson and Mike Macklin drawing this. So you've got a very, very heroic, super muscular bound guy. He's got, you know, muscles everywhere. He's sleeveless vest. He's got, it's all purple with gold highlights. He's got on purple pants and then purple thigh high boots. And he is just smiling like as best as he can. Great surprint of all blue. You see him rocketing away from his planet where he's doomed. You see him saving some kids. And then you see him fighting the Justice League, fighting Superman, Wonder Woman, and Batman. So before we get into his origin here, what do you think of the art?
I like it. Actually, we just talked about this over on Siskoid Show, who's editing, because that was the issue that we did, and we had to come up with pitches for Ultra having his own book, which, you know, kind of a dubious assignment there. But no, I like this character just because he was kind of, you know, a recurring feature but he appeared in Justice League of America a couple of times. And so I love that book. And so, it was a fun idea of this guy who's, you know, good natured, but way too powerful for his own good and constantly sort of being tricked into doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, he's kind of the Superman of Earth Prime. And if you remember, Earth Prime is supposed to be our world, right? Where we buy comics and have our dreary jobs. But he was the one solitary superhero on Earth Prime. And he came from a dying world, just like Superman. And he was, but in this case, he was raised in Australia by the Aborigines. So the Justice League in one of their 1970s crazy story. Okay, I'll put it out there. I love the look of Ultra. I love the concept of Ultra. I have an unearned love for the concept and everything because I always felt like the execution was done poorly. Like, I hate to say that. Like, all those stories with him just make me roll my eyes. Because, I mean, the JLA come to Earth Prime. They can't leave because he's a superhero there. So they got to talk him into coming to Earth One. So he comes to Earth One. And then, like you said, he reoccurs as an antagonist because he's just an idiot. And people keep convincing him to do crap. And it's like, just irritating. Again, I love the concept. And I love his look. That purple is just so striking. So, and now he gets wiped out with the crisis. Like, he never existed in the crisis, right? But in post-crisis, they did bring him back. So here's the crazy thing. Every time I look at this character, I think, okay, red hair, super heroic, lots of purple. It reminds me of the character of Maxima, who's a post-crisis character, Superman sort of love, villain, eventually hero, joins the Justice League, all that kind of thing. Derek Crabb loves the character.
Derek William Crabb's favorite, yep. Yes.
So I've often wondered, was Maxima inspired by Ultra? Well, I don't know whether this is a chicken and an egg and I'm misremembering, because in the post-crisis version, I had to look this up, Ultra does come back and he's actually from the same planet as Maxima. So I don't know whether, this is an original thought in my head or whether I'm just being influenced by what I read. I don't know, but he really does feel like he fits with the Maxima world of Amarak or whatever, wherever she's from. So anyway, again, I love the look. And Eric Larson just really delivers on the super happy superhero kind of thing. And I just love it. A lot of fun.
I am going to say I'm calling shenanigans on 64228.
No way. Absolutely no way. Yep.
No.
Correct.
No.
Not with those kind of muscles. Now, I got to ask you, the thigh-high boots over the pants, is that too much?
You'd have to ask Shawn Myers about that. I don't really know. It seems like it's hot. You know, especially since he ends up with his last story, ends up down in Australia out in the outback. Like, that is hot out there. You really don't need to wear all that, but you know, I don't know.
I think it's hot in multiple ways. But anyway, all right, let's move on. Randomizer.
All right. So we go boop, 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 boop. 25, issue 25, Vandal Savage.
Woohoo!
The Immortal. Vandal Savage here, drawn by Dennis Cowan and Greg Brooks. We're not making any jokes. It's a
come on, it's a killer of a joke.
Yeah, all right. The man. Okay, so Vandal Savage first appeared in Green Lantern first series number 10, which again sounds like the 40s one. Well, no, there was no. They're not talking about they're talking about the Green Lantern, wait a minute. Which Green Lantern are they talking about? Wait, I'm confused.
Alan Scott.
Talking about Alan Scott. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cause there was a Green Lantern book.
Yeah. He's an All-American Comics, but then got his own series.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. I got confused there for a second. Anyway, we see this, the inset here where he's squaring off against both the Flashes and he's lording it over Superman. And basically he's an immortal. He's been around since the dawn of man. He claimed to be over 1 million years old, although his arch enemy, the Immortal Man, places his age at approximately 50,000 years when Savage was the chieftain of the tribe of Cro-Magnons. So, wow. Okay. That's a thing. And, he looks pretty cool. I mean, again, the idea of an immortal guy, you know, again, they talk about by the 1940s, Savage was bored, which I would imagine you would be if you just lived forever. So this is a character that, you know, pops up every so often because, again, he's immortal. He can never really die. So I remember he was used effectively in Crisis, I actually thought, because I thought he was actually, they used him sort of effectively in that series. It's not a bad drawing. It's not super great. I love his logo. The logo is fantastic. Very exciting. And by the way, it says his original name is Vandar Adge, which is just awkward as all get out. And it feels like that's something like Legion of Superheroes would have used. But yeah, that's Vandal Savage.
I like that Cro-Magnons felt the need for a first name and a last name back then. So that's good.
Did Cro-Magnons worry about Christian names then?
Was that I don't know.
I don't know. It's like old Fred Flintstone celebrating Christmas. There's a lot of listing here, by the way. There's a lot of text.
So a couple different things. I mean, one of the things in all these centuries have been alive, one of the things he likes to do is sort of become the advisor to the throne. So he's advised all these various conquerors over the years on what to do.
He's the little finger.
Right, exactly. Yep. So in the 40s, he decided to advise the Axis. And so that's why he comes into conflict with Green Lantern and becomes part of the Injustice Society or again, Justice Gang or whatever it is of the world. So he's in there. So, all right. So first of all, the drawing, he's very slight. He's a tiny dude. He's only 5'10", 176 pounds, which, you know, that I could kind of believe given how skinny he's drawn there. Nowadays, they draw him as like a giant beefy.
Yeah, he's super
very
big,
broad. Yeah. And it's interesting. So, all right, I played this game with you a little bit earlier. So guess how many Golden Age appearances he had? This character who's, you know, been all throughout history. We've seen him a million times. How many Golden Age appearances do you think?
Oh, I think I've fallen for this trick enough times. I think it's, we're going to find out it's like five or something.
Two.
Two.
He had two Golden Age appearances, just a couple of Silver Age appearances. Then it was the late 1970s. He exploded and has never stopped being a major character in the DC universe at that point. You know, Marv Wolfman brought him into the Superman books and wanted him to be like Superman's big nemesis. And in fact, in post-crisis, he wanted, instead of Lex Luthor to be the big one, he wanted Vandal Savage, but they went with the Lex Luthor kind of route instead. I think he wanted Vandal Savage to be a businessman. That's what it was. And they decided to give that to Lex Luthor. And so that's what it was. Either way, he has made a gazillion appearances since then. Every time there's a historical story, he's in it, you know, because he's been alive all this time. He's a little bit like the Kingpin because he's, you know, he's in control of everything, but no one can ever pin anything on him. He's also a little bit like Ra's al Ghul with this, you know, never dying kind of centuries long plan. I'm going to put it out there, and you guys feel free at home to argue with me. Or I think he is, I don't know if most successful is the right phrase, maybe most successful or the best JSA villain. Boom, right there. I think he is the most significant JSA villain in DC Comics publication because of everything they've done with the character. You agree? Okay.
I don't know about that, but.
Okay. All right. Well, he comes back in the 70s, you know, in the Super Squad era a little bit, but then he's just always around. He's always behind the scenes, always manipulating. I mean, he's been in the Justice League cartoon, Justice League Unlimited. He was a major player in the Arrowverse. He was the main villain in Legends Tomorrow for a whole season. He's in the Young Justice cartoon, every kind of animation you can think of, video games, all this stuff. So I just think he's a cool character. I mean, maybe not this representation in, you know, in issue 25 of Who's Who. I mean, the art's fine, but it's not the version of Vandal Savage I think of. I think of a giant, broad, you know, on the edge of savagery kind of character is the way I like him. But, and if you want more, of course, you can, again, check out your JSA type stuff like, JSA Presents, Earth 2 Podcast, World on Fire, or the JLU Cast podcast is also a great place. And at this point, the last time he'd been seen was, when he was fighting the Bronze Age Superman in 1984. So it was going to take a little while for them to find a place for him in the post-crisis world. All right. So the last one is, and for this is our 13th entry from the randomizer from issue 25 is the White Witch. More Legion of Superheroes, Rob. How exciting.
It's amazing. We didn't hit a single Omega Man. Oh, in our first venture.
Bite your tongue. We're going to have a bunch next time. So we got Mike DiCarlo and Larry Malmsted is on the art. And White Witch, the artwork here, it's an interesting character. She is completely white. Like, her skin is white. Her hair is white. Everything is white about her. So she's almost in a single, you know, black ink and white. They put a little bit of shading on her. They use some magical sort of pinks and stuff on there. But she's in the center with her arms raised above her with this, I think, a really cool-looking outfit where it's, you know, it's the Legion leotard, which has got kind of a bustier. And she's got a big flowing cape that comes down the middle and splits. It looks great. And the surprint, you've got her and her sister, which is Dream Girl. Could you imagine having Dream Girl as your sister? That would be kind of a... What am I trying to say?
I don't know.
A lot to live up to. Dream Girl. Okay. I mean, Dream Girl's, you know, Dream Girl's exactly what her name says. Then you've got her performing magic. You got her fighting Mordru. You got her with Invisible Kid. And then you've got some sort of Kirby crackle going on there with, looks like Jonah, which is Ultra Boy, and maybe Light Lass. So, what do you think of the art?
It's nice. I think the character's visual is pretty boring.
Oh, okay.
And generally, just an all white character is a little hard to make. But in terms of the composition of the piece, it's nice, and I love the use of the colored surprint. The her power mm-hmm. is in the magenta. I think that's a really nice touch.
Yeah,
like, I'm assuming that's DiCarlo who added that in pencil, or at least put that, you know, told the colorist put that in. But so that's really nice. But yeah, I mean, it's the this is one of those get 5'8", 118. No. this is just one of those Legionnaire characters I just know nothing about because any Legion comic I ever read never featured this character. So I never really, even though she's been around since quite a while.
I know very little about her too, actually. And by the way, I forgot to mention one of her big features is these antennas that come out of like her eyebrows. But, I know because she wasn't in most of the issues I read either. So, again, she's the sister of Dream Girl, which is, you know, that's gotta be hard growing up because Dream Girl's, everyone thinks she's beautiful and all this stuff. But she, in her species, she was considered handicapped because everyone in her planet has precognition powers except for her. She's precognition challenged. And so she goes off to this place called Sorcerer's World to learn magic because she wants to have power. And she does pretty good, and she finds out she's pretty powerful. She ends up getting sidelined, though, by dealing with Mordru and Prince Evilo, causes her all kinds of problems. Eventually, she does join the Legion around the Great Darkness Saga. And at this point, Legion of Superheroes was on issue 32 of the Baxter series, which is a storyline some people remember called the Universo Project. So, but it's a very beautiful piece. I think it's very nicely done. I love the Kirby crackle in the surprint, which I think looks great. Overall, in her font for her logo looks really cool as well. All right. So, Rob, I'm going to ask you here, the same as we asked in the old versions of Who's Who, out of these 13 entries, which were the best ones?
How many do I get to pick out of 13?
I mean, just talk about whatever the hell you want.
Brain. Mm-hmm. Brain, certainly great. Cyborg, yeah, again, Perez in his prime, you can't beat that. And OSS Agents, I love that one. Okay. You know, oh, by the way, I did find out, just well, since we moved past that, I was curious. So Mark Merlin lasted 50 issues, right, as Mark Merlin, right?
Okay.
Then he turns into Ra-Man.
Uh-huh.
He's out of the book by issue 80.
So, like, what was that, like, five issues or something, or what?
Something like seven, basically.
Oh, my gosh.
He's in every one. Now, okay, they did change the book into a straight-up horror book. You can literally see the book becomes – it goes from Eclipso and Prince Ra-Man to, like, those great Neil Adams horror covers, because obviously the comics code was getting relaxed and they could do more. But it's sort of funny that they, you know, this perfectly fine character lasts 50 issues, and then they're like, let's reboot him. And then 7 months later, like, nah, he's out. So that was it for Prince Ra-Man.
But I want to find the issue where Prince Ra-Man fights Eclipso, because that happens. They fight
each other. Yes, it's on the cover. You can see it. It's actually on the cover, one of them. But in terms of, okay, so out of 13, I'm going to pick, like, again, my handful of favorites. I'm going to say Brain, Cyborg, and OSS, I think, are the top ones.
Okay. My runners up were Brain, Icicle. I really love what Paris Collins did with Icicle. I think it's a lot of fun. Not that the character's exciting, but it's just a fun way you put the piece together. Secret Society Supervillains has got to get a nod for just being so overwhelmingly awesome.
Sure, volume.
Yeah. It's like the antithesis of the All-Star Squadron piece, right? It's just like, whoa, a million characters. And then my winner, though, was Cyborg. I just think that one is such a great looking piece. Such a great piece. So. Well, this was fun. So again, we're going to have these 13 images over on our gallery, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We will feature your feedback next episode. So leave your feedback on the website about the, again, we'll be reading feedback from the comments section of our website. We won't be pulling comments from the social media and all that stuff. We're going to pull comments from the website just because that's the best way for us to keep track of that. So Rob, what do you think of our little experiment here for Who's Who review number one?
I enjoyed it. I think that part of the appeal of doing Who's Who in this format is that it's a manageable size, because this episode is going to top out at a little under 2 hours, which I think is reasonable. That was part of the problem.
Feedback, though, it's going to be long.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's going to get even longer. But I mean, at least, you know, I don't know. It's a manageable length, at least for now. So no, I enjoyed it. It was fun going through these again. This is such a good book, and it. You know, it still pays dividends to look at them again. And obviously they have a new life because they've been collected into these editions, these giant editions, and people are buying them. So
Yeah. And don't forget, they're available digitally too. If you're on the DC Infinite subscription, you can get it there too. This is great. Well, all right, that's going to do it. So next time, folks, that'll be another 13 random entries. So, and again, be watching for some Who's. I've got an idea for a Who's That, maybe with a particular magenta buzz at some point that'll happen. And then we'll have the flashback episodes, and we'll have more Who's This. And we don't have a particular schedule, but the goal is to get these out more frequently, certainly than the more recent Who's Who episodes.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't be hard.
And of course, you know, we're going to there. You know, I did the math, Rob. There's enough entries, I think, to do like 60 episodes of the show. So I say we do all 60 and then still wait to do Impact just to piss off Frank and do Impact at the end.
Well, that's the last episode. The
first right, exactly. Ever is Impact. All right, folks. Well, that is going to do it. So, Rob, until next time,
who's next?
Next. Still not getting that right.
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC Who's Who. Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger.
about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC Who's Who.
Aw, man, we forgot Slipknot.
Monsieur Malat?
Sentiment. Kindly send him in, please.
I thought you said this was fixed.
It was working this morning.
We have access to the most advanced alien technology. And we can't even...
Let me just try and see if I can.
Just leave it.
Okay, fine.
Leave it.
Okay.
Maureen, send him it!